Up next, still another witness to the Rendlesham Forest incident. Paul Tyczynski joins us. He heard all of the radio transmissions the night of the encounter. We'll talk with Paul and James Fox in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Now, James Fox and I would like to introduce you to Paul Tyczynski, a retired Air Force member. Paul was posted on Fox One, an entry control point for an aircraft parking area for what was the A-10 aircraft. The post was across the taxiway from the Central Security Control and approximately 200 or 300 yards from the weapons storage area on RAF Bentwaters. Paul heard all the radio transmissions the night of the encounter, and here he is. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Pretty good. How you doing?
Good, good. And James, tell us a little bit about Paul and your relationship, how you found him.
So Paul and I spoke a night or two ago about the incident. I was amazed, Paul, that you, because you hadn't spoken to Jim Pennison since 1984.
Yeah, and 84,
you described what happened to me when we had our first conversation. And I just thought, my God, this cooperates exactly what I've heard from Cabansack, from Burroughs, from Penniston. It was amazing. And then, of course, I turned you on to that link that you could see that one segment of I Know What I Saw. So you could, you know, it was so very impressive. And I'm dying to hear more.
Yeah. Tell us now, Paul, did you see anything, first of all, before we get to the radio transmissions? Did you see this object?
Oh, no, not from where I was at.
Okay. All right. Tell us about the radio transmissions. When they first started coming in, what did you hear? What was the chatter?
The night started off, it was a slow night because it was around the holidays, Christmas time, and we were doing stuff on the radio we shouldn't have been doing, goofing off and stuff, and then the controller come across and broke in and dispatched Jimmy Pennington and
And Burroughs, I guess.
And Cabansack was with him to rendezvous with Burroughs to investigate a possible downed aircraft out, the east gate of Woodbridge. And, basically UFO type of deal. And Jim Pennington came back and was like, is this for real or is this a joke? And then the controller got real serious. He said, no, break. This is the real deal. No unnecessary radio transmissions this time. And then, they went and dispatched, Pennington with Cabansack and Burroughs to the east gate to go off base and investigate.
How long did it take Pennington to get there, Paul, in terms of before the next radio transmission?
It was in a couple minutes, nothing,
That's all. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. As he was approaching, we just talked with him, but I want to get your views and your thoughts on this. What did you hear coming from the Pennington group?
Well, when they got dispatched off base, you could hear when they were doing radio transmissions, you could hear in the background, you could hear, them talking about the animals acting all crazy and, like they were upset, disturbed, and, it was really weird, and they were seeing lights. An object, and they would get close to it and move, and, to the point where they were up on it. The radio transmissions themselves started getting interrupted, and one of our flight sergeants was out there, flight chief, got to the point where he was having to relay Pennington and Cabansack transmissions to the controller to, let him know pretty much what was going on.
Now, this happened in 1980, so they were well aware of UFOs. Did they use those words at all when they came up to the craft, Pennington and Burroughs?
Well, they were initially sent. It was for unidentified flying object.
Okay, so when Pennington came on, and when I talk in terms of Pennington, it's he and his group. When they came on to the scene and they could physically see this thing, what did they say? It looks like a plane, or this looks like it's out of this world. What did they say, Paul?
Oh, they didn't know what it was. I mean, it was nothing. It wasn't an aircraft for sure. Something. Pretty much something they'd never seen before.
Could you sense an air of excitement or any feelings of being scared from their voices?
I don't want to say scared. Paul's compliment, maybe. I mean, and like you said, everything was quiet. Nobody, you know, nobody else was, you know, trying to cut in on any of the transmissions. I sat, I mean, I sat there and it was like, you know, kind of amazed what I was listening to.
Oh, sure. As they were walking around the craft, were they radioing back to you guys what they were seeing?
Yeah, they well, at that point, they were having problems with the radios, and they were pretty much transmitting through the flight sergeant. He was acting like a go-between, a repeater. You know, what they were seeing lights. The animals were getting, you know, crazy. You know, it was acting really weird. And again, like I said, it kept moving away from them, and they got to the point where they started coming back, and it was in front of them again. And then, you know, at that point, I think is when, you know, Jim approached it and got close enough to touch it.
When it finally took off, Paul, did they describe over the radio?
Yeah, it was just
this
gone.
Thing was like, leaving.
You know, snap of a finger, and it was gone.
And they seemed like they were amazed.
Oh yeah, it was. Yeah, the thing was moving like nothing we'd ever seen.
After the fact, what did you folks talk about?
As far as talking to them guys?
Yeah, or chatter amongst each other.
It was like they were sort of out of pocket for a couple of days because, you know, they were pulled in for, you know, debrief, investigation, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, they were pretty much put into the point where, you know, it was a shut up. They couldn't talk about it. They were clammed up and, you know, really couldn't talk about anything.
Were there rumors circulating on the base? Was there like an underlying, like something going on behind the scenes? What did it feel like, Paul?
Well, it felt kind of weird because when this stuff got out, and I didn't mention this to you the other night when we talked, but it was like our flight itself was like, you know, we were like a bunch of whack jobs. That,
really?
You know, we were like the redheaded stepchildren. So it happened again, you know, a night or two later. Then it was like, okay, now we were off the hook and, you know, somebody else has seen this thing.
Then this was getting pretty darn serious, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Did you come up with your own theories, Paul, on what the heck this thing could have been?
Listening to them guys, it's something we don't have. I mean, like I said, you know, Jim's been around a while. I went to tech school with Cab. Cab was, you know, Cabansack was a pretty good guy.
Yeah.
And like I said, they'd seen something that we didn't know what it was.
Are you convinced they saw something that it wasn't a joke or a hoax?
Absolutely. I believe that for a fact.
James Fox, did any of the members out there, or Paul, maybe you can help us too, did they ever get radiation burns or anything like that?
Well, you know, it's really funny you should mention that, George, because when I introduced Jim Pendison, I believe, to Nick Popper, when they met up in Washington, D.C. in 2007, I guess some documents had released from the MOD that Nick Pope had, basically saying that and this is something he never knew about, Jim Pendison never knew about, he was exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. So anyone who went near this thing, and of course the radiation readings the following day at the landing site were really high, but they were exposed that night to high levels of radiation.
And how's his health now? Is he okay?
Yeah, he's okay. John is complaining about some things, and I'm sorry, we should have asked Jim when he was on. I'm not entirely sure. I know there's been some he feels ramifications, but I don't know. Paul, have you heard anything about this?
Well, the following day, I didn't go out. It was our day off, and I didn't go out, but there were some guys that had gone out to the crate where the site was of where the object was, and they had seen the burn marks in the ground where something had actually landed. There was trees were broken. Supposedly somebody was out there with a Geiger counter or something. They were picking up levels of radiation.
Did anybody talk about the possibility this could have been a Soviet craft, Paul?
There was all kinds of rumors floating around. I mean, the Brits even thought it, you know, there was an article in the paper by the Brits that, you know, they thought we were covering up one of our aircraft that had crashed with a nuclear weapon on it, and we didn't want to come clean that we had, you know, there were nuclear weapons.
Wow. But this thing took off. A crash plane couldn't do that.
No.
Did was there any helicopter activity over the scene at all?
No. The only helicopters in the area would have been, we had a pararescue unit and stuff, but they weren't activated. They weren't doing anything that night.
Here we are now, 30 years later, Paul. What do you think?
It's still unexplained. I mean, I've seen a lot of stuff on it on, you know, different TV shows and you know, some articles I've read and stuff, and it's still, you know, nobody's disproven it.
I don't know if you were a believer in extraterrestrial life in 1980, but are you now?
It was definitely something that's still unexplained.
Yeah, I mean, we can't say what it was, but we can't say what it wasn't, right? I mean,
exactly.
Or you can say what it was, I'm so sorry, but we can't confirm exactly what it was. And that's the fascinating thing about this. I mean, you do the process of elimination, what's left, you know? It doesn't appear to be, I mean, from the witnesses I've talked to, Paul, you probably agree with me, it doesn't appear to have been of terrestrial origin, but who knows, right?
But again, like I said, you've got people that are trained and know what's going on, and when they can't, you know, explain what's going on, it makes you wonder.
It really does. Well, Paul, I want to thank you for your insight into this. This is a remarkable part of the story.
No problem.
Paul, thank you so much for coming forward tonight. Really, really appreciate it. And if there's anybody else out there that wants to join us to come forward about this incident, this is the 30-year anniversary of this incident. Contact us on our Facebook page for I Know What I Saw.
James, as you look at this thing now, 30 years of this case, the Britton Roswell, basically, what are you concluding? I mean, you've investigated a lot. You've looked at a lot of cases. What do you think happened here?
I think this is one of the cases that we could actually take and present to members of Congress with enough witnesses. There are enough live witnesses left, coherent. These men were young at the time. They're in their late 40s.
Solid,
50s.
Truthful. They're not gaining anything by this.
You know, the fact that Paul came forward, he's feeling comfortable enough to come forward. I got contacted by another guy who's possibly wanting to come forward. There's talk of a guy that was in the tower that saw the whole thing from the tower of it taking off.
Burroughs has come forward.
It's the 30-year anniversary. I think what we should do is we should have a big event in Washington, D.C. We should invite all the members, all the witnesses out to it. We should possibly have a little screening, invite members of Congress, invite the media. And really expose the truth about this. It's such a solid case. And I hear people in the UFO community say, oh, well, we've been there, done that. No, this has not been explained. You heard what Paul just said. This is still unexplained. Let's get to the bottom of it. Let's demand answers from the United States Air Force. Let's demand Congress to put these guys on as witnesses, on stand, and testify. And let's get answers.
We had some audio a long time ago of Colonel Hult making his way through the scene there. And
oh, my gosh, it's amazing.
It is great stuff.
I reunited Colonel Hult Monroe Nevels for the first time in, I think it was 27 years. They hadn't seen each other. And they just, like, finished each other's sentences for each other. Do you know what I mean? They hadn't talked about this thing since it had happened, pretty much.
Do you think that Peniston and company got onto the scene too soon because this thing, you know, stayed there, landed for a little bit, and then left? Do you think they were taken by surprise, the craft, the occupants, maybe, if they were inside?
Well, I do know this. This is what Colonel Hull told me. He said when he heard about it, he kind of chuckled to himself. He was the deputy base commander. He kind of chuckled to himself. And when the lights reappeared, I believe it was a night later, he went out with a crew of people, I think five. Nevels was one, number of guys, with, you know, the distinct idea that there was a prosaic explanation behind this, and he was just, you know, come on, I'm going to go resolve this once and for all, and he found himself in a situation that he had no idea how to deal with, and all the other men. They said this object was shooting beams of light down into the weapon storage area, and they were doing these. He said, Colonel Hull told me, he said they were looking for something. I said, well, how do you know that? He said, because they were doing a grid search in the sky, these objects, and they'd fly soundless, just like the way Jim described them flying. They would do 90-degree angle right turns. They had the ability to stop and disappear in the blink of an eye, and then they shot beams of light down into the weapon storage area, and then they shot beams of light down right at the feet. And this is all on tape, you know, audio tape. Right at the feet of Colonel Hult and the guys that were with him. It's just amazing to hear this story. What were they doing there? What were they looking for? You know, weapons? It's crazy.
Well, I was going to say, if it was ours, what would we be doing there? So that doesn't make any sense. Is, you know, landing out there in the forest somewhere, that it just doesn't make any sense. And then leaving again like that?
There's been so many different, you know, in my previous film, Out of the Blue, I document a lot of cases where UFOs and nuclear weapons are spotted. And it seems to be a point of interest to someone. I mean, White Sands, New Mexico, when all this, you know, the modern day UFO thing started, you know, Minuteman missile cases in Malmstrom Air Force Base. I mean, this, and then you've got Bentwaters, which at the time nobody knew they were housing nuclear weapons, but they were shooting beams of light down into the nuclear weapons storage area. And what was the craft doing sitting on the ground? I mean, my God, it's just, it's crazy. So I think that all the elements for, if any story is going to break this into the mainstream, I think that Bentwaters has all the ingredients to do that. There are enough witnesses. There's enough tangible evidence. Obviously, having a photograph of the craft would be great, but we don't have that.
Oh, we came close, didn't we?
You know.
They gave them away.
I said the same thing to Jim Pennison that you said to him. When the first time I ever interviewed, I'll never forget, he talked about the photographs. And later on in the interview, I said, wait a minute, you took photographs? What happened to those photographs? You know, then he told me, very frustrating.
I would have put one in my back pocket at least.
You know? No. That's sort of but you know what I find, George, even if a really good photograph is out with points of reference, I mean, look at 1950, Trent, the Trent, you got multiple eyewitnesses, got the crystal clear, totally in focus, points of reference, no scientific, I mean, they're even analyzing Condon report, and yet people say, oh, well, if those UFOs were real, then we'd have, we do have photographic evidence. Some of it is pretty, quite impressive, actually, you know. The Trent photos, case in point, two photographs, two witnesses, points of reference, crystal clear, negatives. But people still say, well, we need a photograph. But they're, you know, anyway.
The Ministry of Defense basically says, this posed no threat to national security. That doesn't tell me anything.
Well, Nick Pope had a very interesting, I heard you mention that earlier, and that's what they said, but he obviously worked for the MOD investigating UFOs. And his response to that was, wait a minute, how can you draw that conclusion when you don't know what it was?
Unless they did know what it was, and maybe it was a friendly ET and they knew that.
Nothing of any defense interest took place.
No.
I remember hearing that from Admiral Lord Hill Norton. He was very doggedly sticking to his guns in questioning the MOD on how they could draw that conclusion.
That was a sightseeing trip by an ET. Just happened to find their way into Rendlesham Forest.
But isn't it interesting how they were shooting beams of light down in the weapon storage area?
Yes.
And if you listen to those tapes, I'm sure people can find them on YouTube. But if you listen to those, the excitement in the voices, then multiple eyewitnesses watching this whole thing go down, the excitement in the voices, they're frightened. You hear the deputy base commander, who's the colonel, saying, you know, oh my God, this is unreal. You know, it's not.
How can folks find your Facebook again?
The Facebook is just I Know What I Saw. And then the website, if you want to view the trailer or if you want to get an autographed copy of the DVD, it's just been released as of about a week ago, is I Know What I Saw, themovie.com.
Super. Stay with us, James. We've got 30 minutes to go, and I'd like to take phone calls with you when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM before we have open lines next hour. James Fox, our special guest, he put together this incredible documentary on the Rendlesham Forest incident, and we'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. We'll open lines next hour, plus a special luck hotline. I'll tell you about that in a second with an incredible story. And now it's time for our traditional shout-out for those of you supporting Coast to Coast AM. Those of you, of course, listening to your favorite radio station across North America, 544 strong, thank you. Streamlink members, thank you. Soon to be called Coast Insider, and there's a reason for that. XM Satellite Channel 165. And then the various chat rooms and groups, of course. NighthawkZone.com, folks. Hello to all of you, including you, Bad Boy, and Nikki Anastasia, and all the rest of you. There's Moondog there and Beyond 92 and the whole group. Imaginative Worlds, Into Infinity, National Radio Club, Sorcery IRC, MySpace Groups, Yahoo Chat, Northern Kentucky Paranormal Group above Top Secret, the SoCal UFO Meetup Group, Hollywood Ghost Hunters, and Greg the Cook in St. Louis. Last night in St. Louis, by the way, before I head back for sunny Los Angeles. Back in a moment with James Fox and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. James, did you investigate the Colonel Hult memo at all?
Yes, I did. I actually featured that in Out of the Blue when that came out, I think 2003. It's so funny because Colonel Hult writes this memo, right? And at the bottom of it, he says this event was witnessed by many. And then he says, including the undersigned. So he very discreetly includes himself as a witness in this United States Air Force memo. And then, of course, he signs it Colonel Charles J. Hult.
Yeah. There it is.
It was really funny. I had a good laugh, and I really read it carefully about the way he describes it. You could find it on – people can just Google it, the Colonel Hult memo. It's what blew this thing out in the open in the first place. But it's funny the way he mentions it. He includes himself as one of the witnesses very discreetly.
Wasn't there a police log involved in this case somehow?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, Pennison had his official logbook, which he never turned in. He kept it. And you see his handwriting, you know, we're at, you know, zero whatever hours and we're approaching the object. And as they get closer to the object, his handwriting becomes progressively worse. When he gets up on the object, his handwriting looks like chicken scratch.
He's shaking like a leaf.
I promise you, I've seen this with my own eyes, the original logbook. And then he's drawing the symbols down on the craft. He's like, you know, put him in his logbook. And he has his logbook and he said, I never turned it in. I kept it. You know, it has all these descriptions. And then when it says, when the object took off, he writes so many details about the object in his logbook, you know, the color, what it felt like, the warmth of the touch, the symbols. And then it says, the object just took off and he gives the exact time and then he puts speed. And then he writes impossible in huge letters with about 15 exclamation points.
Amazing.
Absolutely amazing.
Amazing. Let's go to the phones. First time caller, Philip in Huntington, West Virginia. Welcome to Coast, Philip. Go ahead. You're on with James Fox.
Hi, thanks for having me. This is my very first time calling.
Well, thank you for joining.
I just wanted to point out, you know, how lucky we are to have heard about this case, thanks to journalists like your guest and everyone else involved.
Absolutely.
Considering that it was military personnel involved, especially, and considering how many, you know, civilians have reported things like this, is it possible there's other good cases like this one that we haven't heard about from the military?
My gosh. Absolutely. You know, think of all the things that we don't know about, you know, some of the cases that happened much earlier, perhaps that, you know, the witnesses are dying off. I mean, so absolutely. I mean, I constantly think about how many cases we don't know about, and I get emails from very concerned military personnel. One guy was a former sheriff all the time, actually, talking about very unambiguous UFO encounters during their official duties quite often, but I don't have the resources and the time to research them all. And, you know, so, yeah, your answer to your question is, yeah, there are lots of.
I mean, it only takes one public information officer not willing to talk to the press or one other person in the chain of information to just give up and not put it out there.
Absolutely. And, you know, as with this case and with many others, you'll get a concerted effort by somebody, don't ask me who, but somebody to diffuse or muddy the whole story with a bunch of bunk stuff. You know what I mean? Aliens interacting with the deputy base. They just, you know, just to kind of dumb down the whole thing or make it so bad that nobody wants to associate themselves with it. It's a very effective campaign. And actually that began, I think, in that whole policy shift happened in 52.
It's understandable. As a hardened skeptic myself, you know, this is one of the few cases that really convinces me there's a real phenomenon, and I think that's why they're so scared of it.
Right. I mean, I think this is one of the cases. I was talking to George about this earlier, is that this is one of the cases I think we can take to Congress. We've got enough witnesses, we've got enough evidence, and really shake things up. And we've got the 30-year anniversary happening this year, so now's the time to strike to do this.
You know, even, and I expect them to say, well, we don't know what it is, but at least an admission, you know, James?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, just to be able to say, we don't know what it was. Yes, we're visited. But Ed Kabansag told me that they forced him to sign a document that said what they saw was just the lighthouse beacon. He's like, I know perfectly well that wasn't. I saw that lighthouse beacon every night. It was sitting on the ground. I mean, he's like, this is ridiculous. He had to sign that. That's what he told me. Actually, I have it, and out of the blue, you can see it. You can Google it or something. But yeah, lighthouse beacon.
Let's go to Casey in Sacramento, California. Hi, Casey. Go ahead.
Well, I was a airman based at RAF Mildenhall, which wasn't too far from Bentwaters. And an additional lead you might want to follow up is the F-111s that used to fly out of Lakenheath, England, RAF Lakenheath, had like the very best radar for aircraft at the time. So,
hello?
Yeah.
Wait, he said so.
You still with us, Casey? Well, he's gone. He hung up. That's weird.
That was really, he was just getting to the heart of it.
He was ready to tell us some kind of a blockbuster. Oh, well.
I was on the edge of my seat, seriously. can I say something really quickly?
No.
There's an event tomorrow. I happen
of course
to be in
you can.
Okay, sorry. If anyone out there can Google the Phoenix UFO Examiner by Larry Lowe, there's an event being put on by Phoenix MUFON at the Vision Quest bookstore in Scottsdale. So if anyone's in the Scottsdale, Phoenix, Tucson area, to come on by. It's going to be tomorrow. I'm going to be there for that. We're going to be showing some clips from the movie, and hopefully, you know, anyone listening could make it.
And you don't stop. Let's go to Feli in Honolulu, Hawaii. Hey, Feli, go ahead. Aloha.
Hi, George. Hi, James. Great show. Just had a short story. A friend of mine's had an incident in Japan where they seem to be followed by a light up in the sky that appeared to be a UFO. And right after that, once she got home, she was under an obsessed spell, it appeared, that she was just making drawings. She's a very good painter and drawer. She started drawing all these scenes of like underground areas and people interacting with ships and all these different things that, and it kind of blew her mind. And she had all these different paintings for a while until later on in her life where she became real religious and decided that this was work of the devil or something like that and got rid of them, you know. And now she can't remember any of that stuff. Or she remembers some of it, but not all of it, you know.
Well, I get, go ahead, James.
I'm so sorry. I was saying I've gotten I get a lot of very supportive email from people, but then I also get that angle from people that are very, very, I don't even want to say religious, I guess, but I think it conflicts so much with their religious beliefs that they demonize it, and I've been accused of like coercion with the devil, and that this is the devil reincarnate coming back. And I mean, just what do I say to that? You know, I mean, this is a big universe, and hey, maybe God created everything in it. You know.
Well, there's a camp out there that believes that UFOs and ETs are demonic. I mean, that's one of the theories I was talking about at the X conference. I laid out a scenario where I concluded that they're coming from planetary systems, even though I weighed dimensional other multiverses as a strong possibility as well. But demons popped up as a very high probability too.
Can I read you a first sentence of an email I got just recently?
Sure.
Hello, James. You are really one screwed up guy. Seeing all those things that nobody else sees mean you really, really need to see a psychiatrist. You're making yourself look like a fool. So I get these like hate mails sometimes too, you know. But I was like, wait a minute, I'm not even suggesting that I saw anything. I'm just allowing a platform for very credible witnesses who claim to have seen something during their official duties. So things, I don't know. People believe what they want to believe, I guess.
It happens. Burlington, Iowa. It's Steve's turn, east of the Rockies. Hey, good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you doing this morning?
Okay.
Fine, thank you.
Okay, my question is, you were saying, I want to know, did that spacecraft go, did it go over the military installation first and beam the light down in there and then take off and land?
Well, from what I understand, on the first night, it was just reported that there was a downed craft in the woods.
Right.
Throughout the base. Now, the second night, when Colonel Holt took a team of men out with him to investigate and figured there was a conventional explanation, he was convinced of it. That is when it was above the base, the very sensitive weapon storage area. And that's the way Colonel Holt refers to it, because he can't admit even now, retired, that there were nuclear weapons. So he says, we had very sensitive weapon storage area. And that's
well, I was kind of wondering because now if it went over that, let's say its propeller or its propulsion system was going over that system or over, you know, over our nuclears and then taken off, and maybe it had to land because it overloaded itself with radiation. Maybe that's what the red crackling was when the gentleman went up to the craft to look at the craft. He said didn't he say it was there for 45 minutes too?
Yeah, about 45 minutes. That was the first night, and then the second night is when it was observed. Multiple craft observed shooting beams of light down into the weapons storage area. But who knows? I mean, anything's possible, right?
I mean, I would, you know, who says it doesn't? Its propulsion system, you know, the nuclear was interfering with its propulsion system, and it had to shed that excess radiation in order to take off again. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I guess that would be my theory. You know what I mean?
Yep. It's certainly a possibility, right?
Sure is. By the way, Casey's back from Sacramento, that call that popped off.
Oh.
Let's go back to him. Go ahead, Casey. There you are.
Sorry about that, guys. Not the greatest phone in the world. What I was about to add to the F-111 story about them having the best radar out there is we had an airplane at Mildenhall that was called the RC-135. And it was the greatest electronic snooping 707 ever built. And it had reel-to-reels on it that recorded everything electronic in the area, and they used to fly it up and down the border of Russia. So that would be another lead that you might want to check into on, like, maybe a Freedom of Information Act, because this stuff was on reel-to-reel, and they replaced the reels every mission. These aircraft flew almost 24/7 around that section of England and going back and forth towards Russia, especially the F-111s that were constantly up 24/7. Now, getting back to the actions of the craft itself, it sounds like a typical unmanned probe that basically just did its job, set down if it needed to, you know, scanned what it needed to with its electronic beams, and then took off on a pre-programmed mission.
Right. Might have taken samples. Who knows?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, kind of thing that we do, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly what we do. And you figure if you have a civilization that's, you know, another 500, you know, years advanced of us, we're simply going to come up with better unmanned probes just like we are right now, the ones that are sitting on Mars right now. If they had a capability of taking off, which, you know, a lot of them don't because we don't have the technology, doesn't mean to say that somebody else doesn't have the tech.
That's right. Casey, the spy missions over the Soviet Union, were there civilians involved in those planes, do you know?
Well, in the RC-135, they had crews of, you know, 15 or 20 people that monitored different sections of electronics. They had different cryptographic machines in them that allowed the analysts on them to, you know, take in any kind of electronic data. And there was also a section of people that did nothing but languages, that took in the different languages. And they were linguists on board that, you know, listened to the different radio traffic going in and out of Russia and in and out of the Baltic countries.
I think my uncle, who is dead now, and he never told us what he did. I think he flew planes like that. He would be gone out of Boston for weeks at a time. And, you know, my cousin, Wayne, he didn't know what he did. But he was an expert in electronics. You never know, James, but I think that's what he did.
You know, there's got to be a repository somewhere of a lot of data, film footage, photographs, that sort of thing. Because a lot of the witnesses I talked to that have been on missions similar to what you're talking about, Casey, where they did come back with, you know, photographs or film footage, some kind of tangible evidence, it was quickly couriered off to Washington. And I've heard that so many times. So there's got to be a repository of the most amazing evidence.
Well, you know, here's something that's interesting too, James. You know, all of the events that have been happening on this planet, cattle mutilations, landings, things like that, seem to be out of sequence, because some people have said, now wait a minute, if ETs have been visiting us since the beginning of time, or they seeded us, they're so advanced, why do they need to test cattle Why do they need to send unmanned craft here and do samples? Well, my logical explanation for that is this. Who's to say that there aren't a number of different races and civilizations
with different agendas,
who may not be as advanced as the group that came here and seated us, but they may be at a point where they're more advanced than us, but they're merely starting to do what we're doing, and that's sending probes out. So I think the different things that are going on this planet are being done by different races or beings who aren't as advanced as some of the others.
You know, I asked this question to Apollo astronaut Edgar Mitchell one time. Why won't they just land on the White House lawn? He said, what would you do if you were exploring space and you came upon life? Would you stand back and observe from a distance, or would you just land in the heart of everything? And I thought, you know, that's a pretty good point. I would probably want to stand back and check out what's going on.
Especially, James, if you witnessed murders, shootings, wars, bombings. Would you come down here in the middle of that?
I'd be like, those guys aren't going to last long.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to say something happened to that planet a long time ago.
They got something wrong in the gene pool.
Yeah. This is the prison planet.
I know. It's the sad truth, George.
It truly is. I don't know. Houston, Texas. Tim, only have a minute left for you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that I worked in one of the secret programs, one of the magic programs. And I went to one of the military academies where I was commissioned. And when I've had hands-on experience with the equipment that we got from them. And one of the things that I can't understand why we don't do is to use the assets that we have with regards to the various Air Force manuals that have secret parts to them that tell you how to deal with these EBEs, extraterrestrial biological entities. I mean, Air Force Manual 1-1 has two parts. One is public, one is secret. The secret side tells how to deal with them. I mean, it's that straightforward. The government's publishing the information for you.
Sir, can you contact me through my website? I know what I saw. If you Google, I know what I saw. I'd love to talk to you further about this.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
that would be
absolutely
great.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to put him on hold. I'm going to put him on hold for you. And get his number. Tommy, get his number for James.
Thank you so much.
I mean, that could be an incredible story all by itself.
If anybody else out there is interested in knowing more, there's been some amazing articles written up recently in a magazine called Open Minds. And it's been very, very good reporting. Very, very amazing stuff. So they can probably Google that, too.
All right, James Fox, thank you so much. Two just thrilling hours. Back in a moment with Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM.